You got 3 seconds. How are you going to capitalize and maximize the potential of that 3 seconds?
Ah, this week you are in for a treat. I have my friend Brendan Kane, who is one of the guys I turn to for strategy on how to tell stories, on how to build more engagement, on how to make a bigger impact with my messages. I wanted to bring him on the show for you guys because the man is a freaking genius. He was able to build a personal following on Facebook of 1 million fans, real fans, in a single month. And then he did the same thing on Instagram in 7 months. The man is brilliant. I learn something new every time I talk to him. He's helped people like Taylor Swift grow their social following. And what you're going to learn in this episode today is going to blow your mind. Right now, Brendan Kane. All right, Brendan, welcome to the show, my man.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on here. I'm so fired up to have you on because I learn something new every time I talk to you. How the hell did you get so damn good at this digital storytelling strategy stuff?
Trial and error. It's just... And it's interesting because I think back on it as like I'm known for digital strategy and generating 1 million followers in 30 days. But I think it's just one aspect or avenue of storytelling, because we've talked about it as well, is really the key to growing an audience quickly is having a strong hook and being able to test content and test messaging at scale very quickly. And I can look back to just even like early childhood. To me, my brain being trained in that way to think differently and figure ways to stand out and grab people's attention.
Yeah, I feel like you're the type of guy who looks at situations differently than most people. What were you like as a child? Were you like, you know, it's one of those things because I know you and I have no idea if you're one of those people who were like falling behind in class because you did your own thing or if you were top of the class. And I think it could go either direction. I would not be able to place that bet.
Well, it's interesting. So it goes... The first aspect of is childbirth. As I had a rough childbirth when I was born, I got stuck in the birth canal, and my right shoulder had what's called Erb's palsy, and underdeveloped my right arm and my right shoulder to the point where I can't straighten this arm out all the way.
Oh, wow.
And I'm naturally right-handed, but I had to learn how to do everything left-handed. So what I think happened is it wired my brain in a different way because from early childhood, even when you're trying to push yourself up or crawl or any of those things, I had to like adjust both ways. Mm. And then when it came to like playing sports, again, I write with my right hand, but I had to learn how to play sports with my left hand. So I think that something in there kind of wired my brain, like people talk about left brain, right brain. And I think that that has a component to the way my mind works and the way I process information. And in terms of school, I struggled very early on. I repeated first grade 2 times because I was struggling.
Wow.
In school. And there was like spurts where like if I focused and I wanted to be good at school, I get straight A's. But then there's other times I would get bored or it wasn't interesting to me.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't like I was failing or anything, but I would like drop to like B's or C's. And then when I got to college, I kind of reawoken to the fact I got to do something with my life. And I thought, okay, I need to invest my time into school. And I just graduated top of my class and all that. But it's kind of across the board.
So funny to me, man. One of the smartest guys I know got held back in first grade twice. My brother as well, who's the CEO of our company, employs 900 people. He also was held back in first grade. It just goes to show that school is like zero measure of success.
Exactly.
But also so interesting that when you did decide to apply, boom, you're top of your class, you know. So it's funny. It's like school can be gamed. And I had another guest on the show recently who talked about how he just cheated his way through college because that was the only way he knew to win the game. He didn't care about the result of knowledge going into his head because he knew that the knowledge he was learning there wasn't going to do him well when he got in the real world. Because like, how often do you use algebra or, you know, refer to points in history and things like that, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I love learning. I just love learning the things that I want to learn and
yeah.
Being dictated to what you have to learn and memorizing things for tests and stuff just wasn't appealing to me.
Mm. Yeah. So what did you do straight out of college? Did you go into some type of marketing strategy or were you like I was telemarketing or waiting tables and things like that? Or what was your career path like?
So I jumped around in college. I actually went to 5 different colleges because I changed majors. I lost interest. I didn't buy into the whole college scene, like the fraternity sorority scene. It just wasn't my thing. I eventually graduated with a degree in film and I wanted to produce movies. And in that process of going to film school, I figured I need to learn about business because I'm going to get into the business side of this industry. And I quickly realized they don't teach you anything about business in film school. So I figured the best way to learn about business is start your own. So while I was going to school, I started to experiment in creating internet companies because that was the most cost-efficient way at the time, and it still holds true today. Like, there was one company we started, like, was that we started for $50, and it was profitable in the first day. And it was just, I don't know if you remember Alexa, the thing that would track, like, rankings of websites. We created a system that could ping the server that would increase your Alexa ranking for various purposes.
Ah.
So when I moved out to LA in 2005 to pursue a career in film, that's when the entertainment industry started to reawaken to digital after the dot-com bust. And started off as an assistant, like everybody else in the entertainment industry, making coffee, running errands, doing deliveries. But again, going back to this concept of what's your hook point? How do you stand out? How do you differentiate yourself? I looked around me and I saw there was tens of thousands of other people that wanted to be producers. But what I saw is there was the heads of studios, actors, directors, people reawaking to what social media was. It was just taking shape and form and seeing the traffic that was happening on digital platforms. And they were asking questions, well, how do we leverage this new medium? And I had experience in creating these internet companies in college. So I said, I can help you with that strategy. Here's what I did in college. So let me just guide you and advise you. And then I don't remember the exact time frame, but I think it was like less than a year, year and a half. I went from being an assistant to building the first digital division for this movie studio and just going down that direction.
And because you knew that and no one else did.
I knew parts of it. Listen, I mean, I only did it for like a year or two, so I only knew so much. But I wasn't like a true expert, but I knew more than most people.
And more than anyone in the movie.
And
business.
I knew that I could figure it out. Mm-hmm. And again, I go from a standpoint of what is going to make you stand out and what is going to make you be different and provide value to people that they want to work with you and they want to connect with you. And that's the direction I decided to take very early on.
Ah, okay, gotcha. And so is that how you ended up working with some of these big personalities? Because you hear a name like Taylor Swift, and you think, well, she wouldn't need to build a following. But back then, no one knew how to build a following
so,
that they could hold on to.
Yeah, when I was working for that studio, I started to get bored really quick with that corporate struggle, as I felt like I was spending more time asking for permission of doing things than actually doing things, and the art of movie making wasn't as creative as I hoped it would be. So in that boredom, I started looking at different things, and I had read an article about Fox acquiring MySpace for close to $600 million, and I wanted to dig in and understand, well, how are they going to actually monetize that and maximize the return on investment of that acquisition? And in looking at that, I just saw the only monetization was these bottom basement CPM banner ads that were on there. And digging in deeper, I noticed that they were missing out on the most valuable form of advertising, and that was peer-to-peer sharing. So if you remember back to the MySpace days, people would embed a Nike poster, a movie trailer, a music video because they wanted to spice up and design their MySpace profile and represent what they were into and what they're about.
Yeah, you'd go on someone's page and it was like a freaking...
It was a zoo.
Yeah, it'd be like a song playing and a music video and billboards and text flying at you.
So I looked at that and I'm like, well, that's peer-to-peer advertising. That's word-of-mouth advertising, which is the most valuable form of advertising. So why isn't MySpace monetizing this? So I went off and I built a technology platform, a prototype that actually could monetize that interaction, where somebody could take their favorite music video or their trailer or poster or whatever it is they were into, put it on their page, and get a cut of the revenue. And the idea is that MySpace would get a cut of the revenue as well. Looking back on it, I didn't realize it at the time because it wasn't such a thing, but it was probably the first ever influencer advertising platform created, because this was back in like 2007. It was before there was ever such thing as influencer marketing or influencers. And in doing that, I got the head of the studio to invest in another business advisor to just build the prototype. And once we had the prototype, we started pitching it around to different companies. So we pitched it to Yahoo. We pitched it to Facebook. And I'm so stupid, I should have just figured out a way to get that deal with Facebook, because at the time there was like 400 employees. And just the patent applications alone, I could have probably gotten some stock, but that's another story. And ultimately, I ended up in a meeting at Viacom and MTV in a boardroom with 15 of the top executives there. And again, I didn't know what I was doing. I was a young kid with a technology. But there was one guy in that meeting that really saw the vision of it. And I ended up doing a licensing deal with MTV for that technology. And we did several tests, and the tests were really successful in terms of the click-through percentages that were happening comparable to the traditional CPM banner advertising. And we did several iterations of that technology, one of which was for Vice, because people don't really realize this, but when Vice got into producing video content, MTV was actually a joint venture in that. They gave them the initial funding to produce that content, and the executive that I did the deal with gave them that funding. Mm. So we created a version of the technology for them. And what we noticed was that it was really successful. The engagement rates were really high, but it was struggling to scale. Because again, this was at a point when influencers wasn't a thing. It's not like it is today,
yeah,
where there's billions and billions of dollars and you have these people with huge audiences. It was just on the cusp of it. So we just were at a point where we're like, this just isn't going to scale. It was too early. And then I decided to start developing a second platform that essentially could dynamically write code for you. So you start from a blank white screen and you could drag and drop anything onto that screen and our system would write the code behind it. So there's platforms out there like that today, like a Squarespace and Wix,
yeah,
but we were very early on. And the platform that we built was very enterprise, where you could build huge complex websites. And again, I brought this back to the executive I did the deal with at MTV because I had a good relationship with him. And I said, hey, here's a prototype. It was very early on. This is what I'm thinking. And he's like, well, let's do a deal. Because at the time, there was this thing called 360 management where people wanted to get in bed with celebrities and athletes and get an all-encompassing deal and be a part of their entire business. Because at the time, MTV was taking these people to stardom through their television stations, but they didn't own any equity. They didn't own any of that revenue source. They were just making stars out of people, and then they were off their on their own, and MTV was kind of left in the dust. So the idea was that this platform could be a tool that they can bring to musicians, celebrities, and athletes to help build a digital and social presence and monetize that activity and take a piece of their revenue. So once I did that deal, the executive's like, hey, do you want to go meet Taylor Swift? And this was probably, I don't know the exact date, it was probably 2009,
okay,
2008. So she wasn't a huge global superstar the way she was today. I have no idea who she was. And I'm like, cool, let's go. Like, I'll meet anybody. And that's where I started to get those inroads through those partnerships that I structured and these joint ventures with these companies that would introduce me to these larger celebrities and create inroads to create technology platforms for them and foster relationships.
Oh, fascinating. And then you were building this platform that a lot of these people, like Taylor, ended up using? Is that?
Yeah, so when we met with Taylor's team, so it was kind of an interesting story of how I actually get to it. So like, first I had to go meet with Taylor's manager. So I went to go meet, like, I think it was like backstage at the Grammys, and I had to go meet Taylor's manager and talk to him about it and present it to him. And then from there, I had to meet with the father, and then I had to meet with the mother. And then after all three of them signed off, then I met with Taylor. And the idea is, and I picked up information along the way that helped me position it first for each individual person, but also for Taylor. And what I heard in those conversations with, at the time, they had spent like $150,000 on an all-flash website. It took them 48 hours to update. The bounce rate was crazy through the roof. I think it was over 90%. And they weren't retaining visitors. They weren't really engaging them. And I also learned that at the time, Taylor, and she still is today, but in a different way, she was very involved in every aspect of engaging with her audience. Mm. Like on MySpace, she was managing her page. She was responding to comments. And she wanted to be involved with the website, but she couldn't. With our platform, we built an entirely new website for her from scratch in 6 hours. And then she could dynamically change every element of it herself. She could change navigation, style navigation, backgrounds, all of it. So when I got into that meeting with her, it was, we were playing around with it together. I showed her that she could simply move the mouse and change everything knowing any code or anything. So that was the starting point of the relationship. And we worked with her and her team for about 2.5 years and added other technology platforms on top of it helped grow the e-commerce business. And then there was also another application that we built that to engage her fan clubs, because she had a fan initiative called Taylor Nation, and we were asked to relaunch it and make it better and more interesting. And in our research, we saw that there was a core of a group of fans, I think about 30 at the time, that actually took the time to read and write code so they can build a Taylor Swift fan site themselves.
Wow.
And we thought, well, what if we could give that power to all fans, not just the people that read and write code?
Oh, interesting. So she could have thousands of websites.
Exactly. Now. So we built an application that literally with a click of a button, we could turn your Facebook profile automatically into a Taylor Swift fan site in less than 60 seconds.
Oh, wow.
Once you click that button, you would grant permissions to get your name and your photos and all of that. It would push it through the API into one of 15 different designs.
On a Facebook fan page, not a MySpace.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it would take your data from your personal Facebook page,
okay,
extract it, and put it onto a website that would be your own official Taylor Swift website.
Oh, I see. Oh,
but,
wow.
But the trick was that it was the exact same platform that Taylor's official site was built on. So once they got this site built for them, again, automatically in 60 seconds, they didn't have to write any code or anything, they could go in there and dynamically change every element. They could delete the whole thing if they wanted to and start from scratch. So with that simple platform, we went from 30 Taylor Swift fan sites to over 35,000. Now,
wow.
I don't know if, I'm sure there's probably some type of record. I've never done research on it, but you just imagine the power of going from 30 fan sites to 35,000 and the amplification of the voice and the brand, and also making the fans feel part of the process, a part
of
the team.
Yeah, when you build a fan site for someone, I mean, you have that. Have you heard of the IKEA effect?
No.
So John Levy, who actually I was thinking of him earlier when you were talking about the thing influencers. He's a friend of mine, and he's a behavioral scientist. And he started this thing called the Influencers Dinner, where he gets 10 people who are all doing very interesting things together for dinner. And he called it the Influencers Dinner back in the year 2000 or whenever he started doing these things. And now it's still called the Influencers Dinner. And people think when they go to his dinner, they're going to be sitting around with a bunch of YouTubers and shit like that, you know, and that was never the intention. But anyway, he talks about this thing called the IKEA effect. So people have a really hard time throwing away their IKEA furniture. They're really attached to it. And the reason why is because when you buy furniture from IKEA, you have to build it yourself. And when you put that work in to something yourself, you gain this attachment and feeling about it. And so I can see if someone puts the work in to build a fan site for an artist versus another artist that they simply listen to on the radio, who are they gonna be a bigger fan of? You know, they're gonna have that affinity towards the person that they put the work in for.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the persuasion books that you've told me about, it's that same thing, is you have them take one incremental step or small step, and it completely changes their perception of themselves in relation to a brand. So with this concept, literally a click of a button, you could have your own personal Taylor Swift fan site versus before, it would take you 6 months to just figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
But with that simple click of a button, it makes them more emotionally invested. And also the fact that it was so easy, it builds success momentum on a subconscious level to have them take extra steps to customize that and make it a more part of how they perceive their self or how they want to share their love for their favorite artist.
Yeah, so that's a good takeaway. If you're looking to have your fans be even more engaged with you, ask them to do something. Because once they put that work in, even if it's just sharing one of your posts or using a hashtag that you suggest or doing a new daily ritual, they're going to think about you and become more involved with you. I thought of the daily ritual because I've got Bulletproof coffee sitting on my counter right now. And I was having a conversation with Dave Asprey, the founder of Bulletproof, about how he created the brand. And, you know, Bulletproof coffee is everywhere. You can even go to Starbucks and ask for a Bulletproof coffee and they'll at least know what it is. And sometimes they'll make you one, right? So when he was telling me about that brand, he told me that that was by design. He wanted to create an idea that changed someone's daily behavior. And everyone drinks coffee, you know, coffee drinkers at least, drink it every day. And so when he could get people to do that differently, which is putting butter on top of the coffee in that case, then they're doing it every day. And then they're thinking about Bulletproof every single day. So it really builds that loyalty.
Absolutely. There's a lot of interesting data and information on that. I studied under the professor at Stanford that run the persuasive technology lab. His name is BJ Fogg. Mm-hmm. And he basically, he taught the founders of Instagram these principles before founding Instagram. And he was an early on consultant at Facebook. Mm. But he created a program called Tiny Habits, which essentially says it's a 7-day program and you choose 2 habits you want to form. But in choosing those habits to start out, it can't take more than 15 seconds. So the one ideal example is if you want to floss your teeth, you only floss one tooth for 7 days.
Oh, he's the one who created that.
Yeah. Okay. So and what it does is what he talks about, and I believe firmly is it creates success momentum. Even if you're doing one tooth a day, subconsciously, it's anchoring a behavior into your daily routine, but it's also giving you the confidence on a subconscious level to build. So one of the biggest mistakes that people make is New Year's resolutions. What do? Is they say, I want to get in shape. So they go to the gym, they sign up for a gym membership. The first day they work out for 2.5 hours. The next day they're completely sore or they're hurt and they're done after that.
Yeah.
So it's like, even just if you're making a New Year's resolutions, like what BJ Fogg would say is just put the shoes by the door or put your shoes on for 7 days. Just build up that momentum, because so many people will ultimately just push themselves too far or push their audience too far and make things too difficult for them to perform a task.
Gotcha.
And then it just falls flat.
So give the audience something easy, like comment on this photo.
Yeah, but it's also got to be something that they want to do.
Okay.
As well. And we often see that with social content, if you're having to ask somebody to do something, oftentimes it falls flat.
Yes.
Like the content should be good enough that somebody on their own wants to comment on something or wants to share it. Now, you can add layers to that if they do like it, then they can add layers. Like, I know you've done it on some of the Instagram posts that have worked really well. I think it was like the car post, and there was another one where you asked people to tag or provide their insights. If it feels organic to the content and it plays into the story, then it works.
Right.
But it's like, even in the movie industry, we saw is if you tell people to buy tickets, like, that's not going to work. You don't need to tell people to buy tickets. It's either the trailer or the TV spot or the content is good enough where they're going to want to buy it, or they're not. By simply telling them to buy is not going to work, and it may actually turn them off.
So true. And I talk about that when I teach people copywriting. If you close them too hard, they wonder, why is this person trying to twist my arm like this? You know, I heard Bob Pittman, the founder of MTV, speak at a conference, and he said something that blew my mind about copywriting, because I'd never heard it before. He said, you can't sell anyone anything. You literally cannot. All you can do is explain how your solution fits their problem. You can only explain, and then they have to put that connection. And in the case of a movie, your solution is their entertainment for their boredom, you know, and you can show the most amazing trailer, and that's either going to do it or it's not, you know. Now, there are things that can spice it up along the way, that by saying, hey, if you act now, you can get the tickets for half price, or you can say, this movie is going to sell out the box office, so hurry. But if they don't care about buying it at all, if they don't care about seeing it, they're not going to care about seeing it quickly. So
absolutely,
they need to be able to see it quickly. A fascinating example that combines a few different things that we've just hit on is the book, The Miracle Morning. Have you heard of this book?
I haven't.
So it's written by a guy named Hal Elrod, and I got to hear him talk about the ideas behind that book. And it's really how to shape a morning routine. And the book is self-published and is one of those like phenomenons. It sells tens of thousands of copies every month. And he was talking about how that happened. And this is what I found really fascinating. He says, with most books, word of mouth is a really powerful driver of sales. And the way that works is they will get the book, and as they are reading it and enjoying the content for that, you know, 2 weeks or however it typically takes someone to read a book, they will be telling all of their friends about it. So I'm reading a book on Genghis Khan right now, and it's fucking amazing. It's called The Birth of an Empire. Go read this book if you want to read an amazing book about history and, you know, the way the world was formed. Anyway, I've been telling everyone about it. But then it's going to be passed, and I'm going to be on to the next book, and I'm going to be telling people about that book. With A Miracle Morning, because he's changing daily behavior, he's getting people to have a different routine every morning, they think about that book forever after they read it. So the next time someone's asking them, like, hey, what's your normal day like? They're like, well, you know, I get up in the morning and I do this, this, and this. Oh, you should read this book that I read 3 years ago that talked about how to set up the mornings, you know? So it has that longevity because he changed the daily behavior that people talk about his book forever after they read it once they take those steps. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I've been studying just book publishing and the mechanisms that grow that. And, you know, I'm surrounded by people that have sold millions of copies of books, and my agents represented $5 billion worth of book sales. And what they all tell me is, you know, you seed 25, 30,000 books into the marketplace, and if your book is good, that's where it starts to take off. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting that I see in this place applies to books or everything is one of the biggest struggles in today's world is the saturation of content in the world. Like, there's 60 billion messages sent on digital platforms each day through text messages, emails, push notifications, whatever it may be. And I find that there's so many people in the world that have amazing stories to tell or have amazing products or services, but they don't know how to stand out in that initial 3 to 5 seconds because we literally live in this 3 second world.
Yeah.
And if you can't capture them with that strong hook, you will never even get somebody to pick up the book, buy the book, read it, or even like when we were talking in our last conversations, get to the actual meat of the story of who you are and what you're about. Like, you look at like Simon Sinek and his why. I think it's an amazing framework for brands. The issue is if you can't hook them in 3 seconds, you won't even get to the why of why you exist and the value of your brand. And it's interesting that the smarter the person is that I meet, oftentimes the harder it is for them to articulate what they do in that succinct way to hook people in, because they're just so smart that it comes intuitive to them, and it's hard for them to break it down in a very simplistic manner.
Yeah. And that's something you talk about a lot. One of your concepts is called the hook point, which I love. And that is that hook that can be shown to someone in 3 seconds that has them say, hey, I need to find out more. Where did you come up with that?
I mean, it's interesting. I feel like I've developed it for the past 20 years, just over the course of just life. And then I think over the past 3 years, I just kind of figured out more of how that applies and actually knowing that I had that skill set, because I've done it so much that I felt like, well, this is a skill set that everybody has. And the more that I dig into it, I find that there's nobody really talking about this. And oftentimes there's a lot of very smart people that I meet that need help with this.
Yeah.
I mean, I can just remember all the way back to high school, where I started out freshman and sophomore year as like a nerd, didn't have friends, had trouble fitting in. And going back to the fact that I was held back in first grade, I was typically older, like a year older. Mm. So by junior year, I was able to drive and have a car on the lot. And then I realized that was a huge asset. So I leveraged my ability to drive as a hook point to make friends. So there was a point where I was literally I had a big Ford Expedition, which is an SUV. There is literally days where I would drive 14 people home in the car and using that. And I didn't know I was using it as a hook point. I just kind of just intuitively just said, how am I going to stand out? How am I going to be different? And use that as a hook point. And I think that's one of the earliest memories I have of doing that.
14 people at once?
Yes, at once, in an SUV, just piled on top of each other.
Nice work.
And they just loved it. They thought it was fun, and they didn't have to ride the bus and things like that.
Yeah.
But then going into the movie industry, I had to look for that hook, and that was standing out and starting those internet companies to get my foot in the door and get the head of the studio to pay attention to me. Then it was creating this advertising technology to get big meetings and big clients and get that MTV partnership, which then led to doing it, you know, getting Taylor Swift as a client or doing a project for Rihanna, and then going to getting into the paid media space and helping advise a company that ultimately started managing $100 million a year with paid media. And I developed hooks to get like Disney and Fox and Xbox as clients off of cold outreach.
And so the hook, like, you know, just pulling a hook out of that would be that you'd managed $100 million in media spend. That's a hook point.
That is, I think, from a larger perspective. But for like when I cold outreached to Disney, it was basically, hey, we're managing campaigns for these big companies. We save you anywhere between 40 to 60% on your media buys, and we increase performance by 3 to 4x. Love to just kind of show you how we're doing that and introduce you to the CEO of the company. And that was a hook to get people to pay attention, because the heads of the media departments and the studios and brands, they're always looking to increase performance, because that's how their success is benchmarked against the bosses that they have to report into.
Gotcha. So what are some famous people that we could talk about to help people understand how hook points work for personal brands? Who are some famous people that have hook points that you like?
Well, I think Tim Ferriss is an amazing one, the 4-Hour Work Week.
Great one.
An amazing one, and he tested that himself. And
that's,
I think,
right,
again, that with that hook point, he was talking about something that had been, it wasn't a revolutionary idea of outsourcing work and streamlining your life. It had been around, and he even admits it, other books that were inspirational in that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But he just was able to position it in such a intelligent way that would stand out. And I think that really is what helped him. I would say another kind of strategy that I actually used was with Katie Couric, in helping her build her personal brand when she went from traditional television to digital media. Is when she went from television to a deal with Yahoo, it completely shifted the human interaction with her content. Because on television, you have this habitual nature built in. Is when she was on the Today Show, you wake up every morning, Today's show's on at the same time. It's a part of your routine. You're eating breakfast, so you tune into Today's show and you'll watch whatever it is, because that's ingrained in you. Versus you go to a digital first strategy and now you're fighting against all this content. There's not this specific time that you tune in every day to watch the content.
Yeah.
And your content started to get lost in that process. And so we had to develop an entire strategy from scratch and basically reverse engineer the art of the interview for digital platforms. And the way that we did that is through hook points. And so I said, okay, let's re-engineer the way that we approach an interview. And most people, what they do with interviews is they just go in with the questions that they want to ask. And oftentimes I feel like that falls flat, because you can ask a question to somebody and they may not give you the right answer, or they may not want to answer, versus if you know what the output is of what you're trying to get out of the interview, then you can rephrase questions, you can push it around in different areas to get what you're looking for. So this, like, it was kind of a crazy story. When I got introduced to Katie, she was telling me this problem, and I had no idea, like, what the strategy was. And she's like, well, how can you help me? So I was put on the spot, and I had to come up with a brand new strategy in 30 minutes. And it ended up being the strategy that we used for 2 years with her. And the way that I positioned it, I was like, who is the next interview that you have? And she said, I'm actually going 2 hours from now to interview Elizabeth Banks, the actress. And I was like, okay, there's even more pressure for me to come up with something on the spot with this. And I said, okay, let's just rethink this whole thing. So we know Elizabeth Banks, she's in the movie franchise, The Hunger Games, which is huge. She was in Pitch Perfect. She directed that franchise and she was a star in it. And then she's also a very strong feminist advocate. So those are our three segments. Those are the three audiences that we're now going to create hook points for. So we went through it and we said, okay, what does the end output or clip look like for Hunger Games fans, for Pitch Perfect fans, for feminist advocates, that's going to make them stop in their social feeds, consume this clip, share it, and then watch the rest of the interview. So we redesigned it with that in mind, where we created these hook points for Hunger Games fans, for Pitch Perfect fans, for feminist advocates. And we wouldn't just come up with one. We would come up with as many as we could think of, like 5 to 15. So that when she would go into the interview, now she has a guidepost of what she wants the end result to look like. And then when we were delivered the final interview, they were typically 30 to 45 minutes, I would go back and cut out each of those individual hook points. And then I would seed them to each of the audiences. So at the end of the interview, we would have 5 to 10 hook points for Hunger Games fans, Pitch Perfect fans, and feminist advocates. And I would take each of those clips and I would basically test each one 100 different ways. So at the end, we would take one interview and potentially have 500 to 1,000 different variations of hook points, and we would A/B test them all against each other in
as
real
like
time.
A headline, is that how you would
as a headline or a hook to draw people in.
Okay.
And if we're testing 1,000 variations, we would dwindle it down to 3 winning variations that were being shared at the highest velocity.
Yeah.
And then we would say, okay, if you like this clip of Elizabeth Banks talking about the Hunger Games, well, why don't you go to Yahoo and watch the rest of the interview?
Got it. And so you grab the juiciest clip. But you didn't know exactly, so you'd test, because we never know. We think we know as marketers.
And that's why you want more. You don't want to just go in with one.
Yeah.
And we use that process for about 220 interviews, ranging from like a Joe Biden to a DJ Khaled to a Chance the Rapper to a Jessica Chastain to a Dolly Parton. And we tested, I think, like 75 to 80,000 variations of content across those 220 interviews.
Wow.
And we just got really good at developing these hook points to stand out, bring the attention back to Katie's brand and the content that they were using.
Wow. And what would you say Katie's hook point is personally?
Well, for her, it's the interviews that she does.
So
that's leading with
like,
that content.
Like just, you know you're going to get an amazing interview with Katie?
To me, the way that I designed it is, I think it's very difficult for Katie just to stand on a hook point in the digital world of herself for people to just come directly in. When I'm talking, and you talk about this a lot, cold traffic coming in, is we develop the hook points to drive the interest in more interviews and longer interviews. So my responsibility is, how do I drive as much traffic into this these interviews as possible? And then you leverage the quality of the interviews and the interactions from the retention standpoint.
Got it. Okay, interesting.
So the whole system was designed on the individual hook points for each...
For each interview.
For each interview to drive the interest.
And then they get to know Katie, but once they're in, off the individual hook points.
Yeah.
So the hook points don't have to be about you.
No.
They can be about your guest.
Yeah.
They can be about... With Tim, it's not actually about Tim, it's about his method.
Yes.
It's about...
Because most people didn't... Like, the 4-hour work week, most people don't... I mean, it's transitioned, but most people don't know that it's Tim Ferriss. And I think Tim made a shift with a podcast of renaming it the Tim Ferriss Experience to draw people into his personal brand so he gets more recognition. So that is something that you got to take into consideration, is you can have a strong hook that brings you in, but maybe bringing in to a product or a service or a brand and not necessarily into your personal name.
Hmm. Interesting. And so you got 1 million followers on Facebook in a month. And Instagram, was it 7 months?
I got to look back at it. I think it was 7 or 8 months once I had it dialed in. Like, it took me 2 or 3 months to really understand how the growth mechanisms work.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And now we can push 150 to 300,000 followers in a month if we have like the right content and the right hook that's driving it.
And it's all about finding what that hook is.
Yeah.
So how would people find their own hook? Do you have an exercise that you recommend? Or what do they know what's going
to
stick?
So it's interesting. I had to go back in developing the book around hook points, develop a framework, because I just realized it was so intuitive for me that I had to build like a strong framework for it. One of the aspects of that framework that I think really helps conceptualize is, I say, if an editor of a magazine is calling you and basically saying you're giving the cover of this magazine in your specific niche, you're the only person on this cover, what is the headline that you want to put on that magazine that's going to represent your brand or your message? And it has to be less than a sentence.
Okay.
But as you're thinking about it, imagine your core audience walking down a busy street. So imagine they're walking down a busy street of New York. You got cabs honking, people knocking into you.
Yeah.
And then you're passing a magazine stand, and there's 50 other magazines on that stand. What is that headline that's going to stand out amongst the 50 others, amongst all the noise and all the clutter? Make them stop, pick it up, buy it, and then read it. Because that's how difficult it is in the world that we live in. Now, in doing this exercise, I don't want you to come up with just one. Come up with as many as you can. You think of 15, 20. And then once you've hit that point, push yourself even further to create even more. Because we often find when you push yourself beyond your boundaries, that's where typically the best hook points come from. Now, another exercise that I actually took from you in a podcast I was listening, I think it was with Roland Fraser, is the story that you were telling about when you first started off as a copywriter and you were coming up with headlines and they all got rejected because they didn't think it was good enough. So what you did is you took popular or successful headlines or hook points from other people and then start plugging in your content to it as well, mm-hmm. which is very powerful as well as a learning lesson of what it takes. So I think that the combination of those two together can be very powerful in starting to establish that. But the most important part of this whole process is you got to go and test. Most people will just come up with one and they say they're done and then it doesn't work and they're like, oh,
yeah,
my brand isn't successful and nobody cares about me or my service or whatever it is. But really, it's the testing that will teach you what works and what doesn't work and help you refine how to be successful in creating compelling hooks.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. That was fucking brilliant. That's a lot to take in. So I want to outline this strategy so people don't have to rewind and play this because you just dropped a fucking amazing knowledge bomb on people. So here's the way to do it. Imagine your core audience. Imagine the people that you feel would benefit from what you have to offer the most. Who is that? Who are those people? What do they look like? How old are they? And think of those people walking down the busiest street in New York with taxis honking, people trying to get them to go into restaurants, things like that. Then they come across a newsstand with 100 magazines on it. What does the magazine with your picture on it have to say below it to get them to ignore everything else going around, reach out, grab that magazine and read it? Because that's the world today.
It is.
Social media,
60
man,
billion messages fucking, every day.
You pick your phone up out of your pocket and you got red notification boxes on 10 different apps and they all seem important. And then your email box is 100 messages, and then Facebook and Instagram, you can literally scroll forever if you want. What is it that's going to get that person to stop? I love that magazine cover analogy. And the technique of mine that you mentioned, it's really not a technique. It was just me struggling to find something that
worked. But I think it's powerful, though.
Yeah.
It's powerful, and it's a smart exercise because so in the framework, I start with a magazine exercise, but I often find people still don't get like the strong output they need from a strong hook point perspective. Mm-hmm. And by far, it's a great exercise regardless. It's a good way to start. And I'll just add some additional layers of where I see people struggle and make mistakes mm-hmm. with these hook points.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, I think the exercise that you started out with in analyzing other hook points, and I always recommend if you see a powerful billboard that makes you stop and look at it, take a photo of it.
That's
you see
it.
If you see an email headline that makes you stop and open it, you'll make a copy of it. Or you see a video that has a meme card that's powerful that made you watch the video, you'll capture that as well. But just some just tips of where I see people go wrong. One tip is they're too long-winded. It has to be something short and succinct.
Yeah, you said less than a sentence.
Yes,
it has to be
oftentimes,
that punch.
Oftentimes, like zero to a million followers in 30 days. That was a meme card I created. I created a campaign on Facebook. It got 16,000 people to apply to work with me. And that was it, zero to a million followers in 30 days. It wasn't an offer, it wasn't a product, it wasn't a service.
Right.
It was just what is gonna capture somebody's attention to allow people to dive in deeper. So that's one thing, it has to be succinct. Another thing is it can't be something that somebody's heard 100,000 times before. And this is a huge mistake that people make, especially when you're talking about social content when you're looking at meme cards. So for example—
And sorry to stop you, but explain what meme card means for people who aren't as nerdy as you and I.
Great question. So if you're watching videos, what people do is you'll have a burned-in headline at the top, which is called a meme card. You could say that it could be a burned in headline or whatever you want.
So when you're scrolling through Instagram and you come up on a catchy video, it's the headline at the top that might say something like, her mother never expected this.
Yes.
And then like a broken heart emoji next to it or something like that. Or like, you know, what this dog did is everything, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
That's the meme card.
Yes.
And
these principles work for anything, whether it's an article title, a book title, or anything. But the biggest mistake people will make is they will use headlines that you've seen 100,000 times. So it'll be like, positive thinking equals success. Mm. Well, I've heard that 100,000 times. I don't need to watch the video because I know what the message is.
Drink water every morning to be healthy
is
the one I use when I'm giving a bad example of copywriting and health. Like, start your day with 8 ounces of water. They're like, no shit, everyone's talking
about that. Everybody knows that. And it's not to say that you're not creating value. You are creating value because it's triggering a reminder, but it's not causing them to be like, I need to dig in deeper and see what this person has to say.
Yes.
So always think about, have I heard this millions of times, or is it overused? And you could, a good example is, or a good exercise is, if you have a meme card or a headline, type it into Google and see if there's exact matches for it, or go into YouTube and see if there's exact matches for it.
See how many there are.
And if there are, then you can do a play on words. But like one trick that we use is subverting expectations and flipping it on its head. So we had a video to give you an example. You've always heard the term, don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
You've heard that 100,000 times.
Right.
But we did it, we flipped it on its head and we said, sweat the small stuff. Mm. So it subverted the expectation of the video and it makes you think, well, why are they saying this? This is opposite of what I've been told. So now I'm going to dig in and watch more of the video, and then you can build that message and build that retention into your content.
Yeah, I can't remember who it is, but there's a financial guru, and he says, get rich slow.
Yep.
And everyone
exactly.
jumps on it.
It's subverting expectations.
Yeah.
Another example is, they don't do it as much anymore, but they used to do billboards all the time where they would flip the headline upside down. So you almost thought it was like a mistake. But it would capture your attention, and then you'd flip your head.
Down.
Yeah, literally upside down. And you would try and pay attention to what it is.
Gotcha. But
what it does, it took something completely different than you ever seen before, or even a simple message that you may have seen before. And just by flipping it upside down, it captured people's attention.
That's so interesting. We've done things on the web accidentally where we've had an error in a sale, and people will buy more than normal, and then you fix the error and the sales conversions go down, and it's because they feel like it's more
sometimes
authentic.
Typos. Sometimes we have ads that have typos in it, not by design, but it gets people to pay attention and write comments, and sometimes it still performs. Like I have an ad creative that's running right now where we spelled Shawn Mendes's name wrong, and it's still converting, and we only had one comment, but that one comment was pointing it out. So there may be other people that see that, but it makes them pay more attention. So just making sure that You're not doing something that everybody else is doing, subverting expectations, making sure that it's not too vague, but also making sure that it's not too specific. Because if it's too specific and it makes people think too hard, then they're going to skip it. Because remember, you're living in this 3-second world. If people are swiping up, they're passing a magazine stand. If it's too simple and something that they've heard before, they're going to skip it. If it's making them think too hard, they're probably going to skip it. So you need to have that balance in between.
Yeah. And let's talk more about that so-called 3-second rule that goes on right now, where you have to catch someone's attention so quickly with all the content that's going on. Because it's something that I learned from you in creating videos, that if you don't grab them in the first 3 seconds, they're going to keep scrolling. Talk more about that.
So first off, the studies show, there was a recent study showed that the attention span is 8 seconds. I don't really believe that.
Gotcha.
The way that we came up with 3 seconds is based off of Facebook and Instagram.
Okay.
So the 3-second rule kind of came into part where I'm sure you remember the old Facebook advertising days when you're doing video view campaigns, they would charge you at a 1-second view.
Oh.
And then brands got into an uproar because people are just swiping and not even the video wasn't even loading, they're getting charged. So then they moved to a 3-second, or 3 seconds to register as a view. But also what we noticed in terms of the algorithms, which controls what content gets reached versus what content doesn't, we see one of the important metrics that we pay attention to is the number of views. Again, a view is counted at 3 seconds.
A view is counted.
Yes.
Got it.
Number of views to the reach that a video gets.
Okay.
So we want to see, and the algorithms want to see, that the number of views to reach is high. So typically we'll say 40 to 50% is a good ratio to start off at.
40 to 50% of the people who are scrolling make it past
3 seconds.
2 to 3 seconds. So really, if they need to make it to 3 to count the view, you need to grab them in 2 seconds.
Yeah, you do.
In a way,
you need to grab them in 1 second so they stop scrolling.
Got it.
But typically they can't read a headline or a meme card in a second.
Okay.
So there, we give them that kind of 3 seconds. And then, that view to reach ratio is very important, because if you do not get them in that first 3 seconds, they don't stick for 3 seconds, you don't get the reach in the algorithm. And that's the big misconception people think they're not getting reach or engagement because they want you to pay for placement. And yes, these social platforms make money off of that, but it's really because they have to keep people on the platform longer. So they're going to prioritize content that is generating more watch time, generating more retention.
So people stay on Facebook and watch more ads.
Exactly. Or YouTube or Instagram or whatever
it is.
Yeah,
they're all the same.
So that first 3 seconds is designed to just capture them and bring them into the conversation. So they'll watch the next 10 seconds, the next 15, 30, 60. And that's where story starts to come into play. Mm-hmm. So when I'm talking about hook points, I'm not talking about clickbait, because you need to have a compelling story. You need to have trust, authenticity, and credibility for the whole system to work. And that's where our hook point concept follows that entire progression. We don't just talk about hook points. We definitely, it's one of the areas I think that we're best at, we focus on, mm-hmm. but we also focus on the fact that you need to have a compelling story, and you need to tell that compelling story in an authentic and credible way for the whole system to work.
Yeah, you know, Bo Eason, are you familiar with Bo Eason? He's one of the best speakers of all time, and he trains people in public speaking. And when he comes out on stage, he doesn't come out and be like, hey, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the nice welcome. That last speaker was amazing. You know, give it up for them one more time. No, he comes out and he goes right into the story. So he'll come out and he'll say, well, actually, this isn't Bo, but he trained my friend. And my friend does this talk. My friend comes out and he goes, when I was 6 years old, my best friend passed away. People want to know what happened next. Yeah. Like, how did the best friend pass away? What happened to you? What, you know, what was it? You know, it's just that one sentence and then they're hooked. It's just like starting right in the action. And that's something I talk about a lot in my talks too. Another thing I see working really well on social media is the element of surprise. You see this on TikTok a lot, where people will do like the jump and then their hair has changed from braids into curls. Or magicians will do this, you know, where they like, I mean, everything magicians do is based on the element of surprise, where you think one thing's going to be under the hat, you know, like a card or something like that. And then they open it up and a snake jumps out, you know, it's like really captivating, this like surprise thing. And I think if you can surprise people either visually with your words or with the subject matter, like for example, in health, we were talking about drink 8 ounces of water every day is boring. One of the things that has done really well for us is a campaign that starts off that says, this is a tomato. Think it's good for you? Think again. And then it's a doctor that's telling them this. So they're like, whoa, I always thought tomatoes were healthy. But then you have this doctor that's telling them tomatoes aren't, and they're like, need to find out more.
Yeah, and that's a compelling hook. And one of the things that also I just want to point out is just because, and this is a mistake that people make, is they think, I need to convey as much information into the first 3 seconds as possible to capture their attention. That's not the case. It needs to be as simple as possible. And one of the biggest mistakes people make is they overload information in that first 3 seconds because they feel like they need to convey all of this stuff. Where it's just a simple hook, like the tomato example, or 0 to 1 million followers in 30 days, brings people in. And once you have people in, then you draw out the story. So it's not like I need to convey everything in 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Is you want to build that retention. You want to build that message. So even though I talk about 1 million followers in 30 days, or you talk about the tomato example, it's not like the next 10 seconds reveals all the answers. You
want to
build the story and build the retention and draw it out in a way that feels organic to keep people engaged and entertained in that content.
Yeah. Yeah. I came across a video that was produced by Goalcast, who makes videos of people who are speaking on stage, and they put them to like catchy music, and sometimes they'll rearrange the person's talk so it's more captivating. And they did one with this poet, Adam Roa, and his poem, I forget how it starts off the way he normally does it.
Yeah, I know Adam well.
But it's, you know, normal slow start to build into this big takeaway. And this line that's in the middle of the poem is, buy this car, you'll get girls. Buy this bra, you'll get guys. And it talks about how that's what society is telling you. And that's in the middle of the poem. But the Goalcast video, it starts at the beginning. And that Goalcast video that rearranged it to start with that line that's just like, wow, it's a great line, got like 200 million views or something like that. You know, so it's okay to rearrange content.
Absolutely.
With a teaser up front. And that's what we're going to do with this podcast too. We'll probably take that knowledge bomb you dropped about walking down the New York street, and we'll drip that out as a teaser so people come and listen to the entire show.
Yeah, Gary Vaynerchuk does that all the time. As he'll lead with a 3 to 5 second hook that comes from the middle or the end of the video.
Absolutely.
The movie studios do this all the time. If you watch a movie trailer on Facebook or Instagram, typically what they're doing is they're cutting a 5 second trailer before the trailer ever starts. Because again, you got 3 seconds. How are you going to capitalize and maximize the potential of that 3 seconds?
So there'll be a trailer to the trailer. They don't tell anyone about that because the trailer is usually 2 minutes, but they'll make that first 5 seconds the most captivating.
Yeah.
So interesting. What I learned from my old boss, my mentor, Eben Pagan, he has this concept called move the free line. And he talks about if you're selling an information product, like a course on how to do something, take your best technique that's in there and give it away for free. And the reason why is because then the people who are thinking about buying it, they learn this technique from you for free and they're like, wow, this is so good and he's giving this away for free. The stuff that I'm paying for must be 10 times as good, you know, because they just like wouldn't believe that someone will give away the best thing for free.
Absolutely. That's like the free book shipping and handling model.
That's like, that's why maybe why your book is doing so well.
Yeah.
Because you're giving away the book that is called 1 Million Followers right there. So, man, this is just a mind-exploding wealth of knowledge you just dropped. Thank you so much for sharing. People want to find out more about your stuff. The book Hook Point is coming out soon, and right now you have the book 1 Million Followers. Can they get it for free right now?
Yeah, they can go to freesocialbook.com.
Freesocialbook.com.
Yeah, if they want to get the book for free. Again, we cover the cost of the book. They just pay for the shipping and handling.
Okay.
They can buy it on Amazon or any major retail store. The benefit outside of just getting the book for free is we have more add-ons that they can opt into, like courses and more detailed video stuff. That they can dive into deeper if they're looking to learn more information.
Yeah, and this stuff works. I have grown my personal Instagram to about 600,000 followers in 3.5 months using Brendan's methods, and Brendan's been helping me with that. I've been so fortunate, but like this guy is on a level that no one else in the world is on when it comes to figuring out what is captivating, what's gonna keep people engaged, and how you can get your message out there to make a bigger impact. So check out his stuff. Brendan, thanks for coming on, man. This is amazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for watching. If you want to hear a story that's even wilder than that one, click here. You only have 5 seconds, though. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!